hppodcraft.com.
I was a young man at the time, and intimately acquainted with some of the actors in this strange tale. The impression which its incidents made on me, therefore, were deep and lasting. I shall now endeavour, with precision, to relate them all, combining, of course, in the narrative, whatever I have learned from various sources, tending, however imperfectly, to illuminate the darkness which involves its progress and termination.
That was the ominous opening paragraph of Chapter 1 of The Familiar by Sheridan Le Fanu, and also a good explanation of what we do here. We try to illuminate the darkness, however imperfectly, on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, I am Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. Who was that reader?
That reader is none other than Greg Johnson.
Yes, Greg Johnson. I've seen him screaming at people on the street. He's great. Glad we could get him on this week.
He's awesome at all things. Exhibit A, his new YouTube music video, Christmas Power. Holy cow, it is awesome.
Awesome is the absolutely correct describer of that video.
Christmas Power is the new Kenny Loggins-esque single from Greg's alter ego, Belgian action movie star, Lunge Dolphin. It's pretty bonkers, but it's a heartfelt tribute to the healing power of the festive season.
And I like to make things up about Greg, but nothing in my feeble imagination could match the actual occurrences in this video. Santa Claus is in it. There's a keytar, which we all know is the unholy combination of synth and guitar. And the baby Jesus pops in here and there.
Yes.
Folks, this is Greg's 8th Lunge Dolphin Christmas short in a row. If you like this one, go back and watch the others with your family. Be a great way to spend your holidays. And we will link out to them in the show notes. Please go check them out.
Greg will also be returning to BBC Two in January for the MASH report. It'll be on again. Don't miss it. Don't miss any of this awesomeness. It's too good.
The MASH report in the UK is much different than the American MASH report, which here it's just a newsletter that gives you plot synopses of MASH episodes. You've read that. I have one here. This is actually for the Halloween episode, Trick or Treatment. It's time for the annual 477th Halloween party. Hawkeye is dressed as Superman, BJ is a clown, Margaret is a geisha girl, Colonel Potter is a cowboy, and Klinger is Al Capone. But it's not much of a party for the surgeons when unexpected wounded guests show up. Charles tries to help a slovenly Marine who has a billiard ball stuck in his mouth. Father Mulcahy inadvertently brings... This is my favorite. Father Mulcahy inadvertently brings a man back from the dead. Inadvertently? What? Well, Chris, much like the finest weird tales, the American MASH report creates more questions than it answers. But that's not what we're here to talk about. Today we are here to talk about The Familiar by Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu. This story was mentioned in the events at Porth Farm, and we like this author, so did Lovecraft, although he did lump him in together with Robert Louis Stevenson, H.G. Wells, Wilkie Collins, and Conan Doyle as, quote, purveyors of the romantic, semi-gothic, quasi-moral traditions. He goes on to write, these types of stories specialize in events rather than atmospheric details, address the intellect rather than the impressionistic imagination, cultivate a luminous glamour rather than a malign tensity or psychological verisimilitude, and take a definite stand in sympathy with mankind and its welfare. It has its undeniable strength, and because of its, quote, human element, commands a wider audience than does the sheer artistic nightmare. The story has that human element that Lovecraft did not like. Coming out of all the impressionistic imagination of Walter Delamere last month, this one definitely seems less weird, but it is full of menacing, unexplainable things as well.
You know, just as a footnote, Wilkie Collins is actually Bootsy Collins' grandfather.
Is that true?
No, I just made that up. I just want it to be true.
Hey, if you believe in something enough, you become a lunatic. I don't know.
That's it.
Let's get into the story.
All right.
It begins with a prelude that ties the story into the other stories in the book, In a Glass Darkly, which are framed as the posthumous collections of an occult investigator by the name of Dr. Hesalius.
Yes, we've talked about this collection of short stories before, In a Glass Darkly, because it also contains Green Tea and Carmilla, both stories we've covered before. And we've talked about Le Fanu, I think, enough, previously. But the collection was first published in 1872, the year before the author's death. The title is taken from Corinthians, a deliberate misquotation of the passage which describes humanity as perceiving the world through a glass darkly. This story was actually previously published as The Watcher in 1851. It was revised for this collection. Much like The King in Yellow or any short story collection with a through line, it's somewhat clumsily attached to these other stories about Dr. Hesselius.
It says that Dr. Hesselius got this story from a Reverend Thomas Herbert. So, right off the bat, we're two layers deep. Mm-hmm. Someone got to Dr. Hesselius's notes on what Reverend Thomas Herbert had said.
There's a short introduction to the story that is part of that wraparound. It includes Dr. Hesselius's notes on the matter. He only says that there's some people who are just crazy, and then there's some people who are open to the spiritual world. And just based on the data from this account, he can't make up his mind if the main character was one or the other or both. He didn't get to examine him, so he's not sure. And that's it. The wraparound isn't very important at all.
The story takes place around 1794 and is about a fella, Sir James Barton, who came back from his time in the Navy during the American War.
The Revolutionary War, yes. Although that seems like it was all a wasted effort now that Prince Henry's marrying an American woman. Think about this. What if they have a kid?
Uh-huh.
The kid becomes president.
Yeah.
And then the right people in the royal family die. Boom. Now the president, also King of England.
Uh-huh.
Suddenly, you know, you're at the Waffle House and they're only serving crumpets. I can see it happening. All gets consolidated.
Was that the plot to King Ralph?
It could have been, yeah.
I haven't actually seen it, but I suspect that that's what it's about.
I haven't either, but I assume that's exactly what happened in there, yeah.
So Sir James Barton is from a wealthy family, and he returns to civilian life after the war in Dublin.
He's around 42 or 43. He commanded a frigate during the war, so he was no slouch. Big deal captain.
Yeah, he's a very respectable and honorable man, but a bit quiet. He has reputation as a free thinker, which I think means he's agnostic or an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
He lived modestly for a rich guy, and he also didn't drink or gamble. He didn't really seem to be into the idea of marriage or children, and most assumed that he would die rich and give all of his money away to a hospital. So people were surprised when he started hanging out with Miss Montague, who was pretty and smart and a total popular scenester. However, she wasn't wealthy.
Right. And, you know, just being cool and a scenester wasn't enough in the late 18th century. You got to have some wealth as well, which seems so strange. You know, you're young and beautiful and you have to pay, or your family has to pay, for the privilege of marrying a guy twice your age who you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like if somebody's going to pay somebody, it should be the other way around.
Well, you know, I guess beauty fades and money,
yeah,
money stays around.
Mm-hmm. That's what they always say.
That's the old saying.
Yeah.
He wanted a wife, and she needed the money, and it seems like he was a basic stand-up kind of guy.
Yeah.
So no one was surprised when he finally proposed to her through Lady L, who is, I guess, Lady J's great-great-grandmother, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Are you talking about Lady J from G.I. Joe?
Yeah, this story is canon to the G.I. Joe mythology.
I just can't believe I had that character name in my brain somewhere.
I think if you're going to remember anything, it would be Lady J.
I guess so.
Anyway, Lady L is Miss Montague's great aunt, and she's kind of her guardian. They weren't officially engaged because they wanted to wait for Miss Montague's father to return from India, but everyone knew that he would be totally down with the marriage, so they just all kind of pretended they were engaged. So Captain Barton is seeing a lot of Miss Montague.
And that's the setup. They've got a promise ring going, and they're going to get engaged eventually.
So Lady L and Miss Montague live in the north side of Dublin, and Barton lives in the south. It's a bit of a hike to go see her, but he is spending a lot of time with her and Lady L, of course, because in the 18th century, when you are dating somebody, you're also just dating their mom at the same time.
Yeah, gotta be chaperoned.
Staying late into the night, and then he would walk back home at the wee hours. The path he takes is through this new street that is being laid out with many foundations for houses being built. So one night, Barton is at Miss Montague's with Lady L, and they're having a discussion about politics, which then moves into the supernatural, as conversations do.
Sure.
The narrator says that Barton's brush with the supernatural has a lot to do with the deliberate conviction of years and utter disbeliever in what are usually termed preternatural agencies. Mm. His skepticism is what's going to get him in trouble. At least that's how the Reverend sees it.
And it's that device of letting you know that the narrator is a disbeliever. So therefore, it adds credibility to his story.
Mm-hmm.
If he actually reports that he's seen something supernatural. We see this again and again. The narrator says that the French principles and Whiggism had led Barton to skepticism, and that it's become fashionable in society because of these elements. And the French principles, I reckon, are the revolutionary principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Whiggism is more specifically about a political philosophy that, in Britain, meant that the parliament was superior in authority to the crown, mm-hmm. that religious dissenters in the country could be tolerated, it's okay for Protestants to be here, and that there shouldn't be a Catholic on the throne who might show deference to the Pope. That was what everybody was worried about.
Right.
And it's all stuff that has weaved its way into modern political thought, but at the time was still something new. Anyway, our guy is part of this enlightened, skeptical, fashionable class, and he's a sea captain too. So by all rights, he should be haunted by sentient mold and fishmen.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
But he's not. He's a non-believer.
So after midnight, Burton is walking home and he swears that he hears footsteps behind him. He stops and looks back there. Nothing. He touches the ground because he's thinking, well, maybe it's my feet that I hear echoing, but it's not making any sound when he does it. So he thinks, my mind's just probably playing tricks on me.
I think the setting where this happens is interesting. You'd mentioned it already, but it's, you know, that it's this new street and there's just foundations around. It's obviously totally silent because nobody lives there yet.
Yeah.
Which makes the effect greater. But the walls are also described as unfinished dwarf walls. It seems like everything in this area is somehow stunted.
Huh, yeah.
Which comes into play later.
The steps start up again, and they're a different rhythm from his footfalls. So he stops and looks around again, but nothing. So even in his skepticism, he's starting to feel a superstitious fear. He stops and turns and he yells, "Who goes there?" But no answer.
But he's a tough guy.
Yeah.
He's not going to just take off running. He takes it in stride. It says, it required a strong effort of stubborn pride on his part to resist the impulse that prompted him every moment to run for safety at the top of his speed. He won't do it.
Now, the footsteps follow him until the end of the street, and then they stop.
He manages to get home, but of course, the experience really weirded him out.
And that ends chapter one. Chapter two, The Watcher. When the captain gets up, he has a letter on the table, which has come from the postman, allegedly. The letter had a strange style of writing that he didn't recognize, and he opens it, and it says, "Mr. Barton, late captain of the Dolphin, is warned of danger," all caps. "He will do wisely to avoid blank street. Here, the locality of last night's adventure was named. If he walks there, as usual, he will meet with something unlucky. Let him take warning once and for all, for he has reason to dread the Watcher," all caps.
It's kind of pretty terrifying to get a letter like that.
He looks at some clues to the letter's origin, but it just has a simple wax seal and no return address. Mm. Also, is the writer Uatu? Or is he a third party?
That was so great that they revealed Stan Lee was a watcher. You know, he has all those cameos in the different Marvel movies. He was a watcher the whole time. Also, that ship that's referenced there, the Dolphin, that he was a captain of, was that owned by the ancestors of Lunge Dolphin? Possibly?
Yeah, this story is also canon in the Lunge Dolphin universe.
The Dolphinverse.
Yeah. But seriously, who wrote this and why? Is it a warning or a threat? Barton's not sure either. I'm not sure.
Well,
he's not sure.
It seems like both to me. It also seems to me like a job for the police. That we, I would be forwarding that letter to them directly. Because maybe they'd go, "Oh, you got a letter from the Watcher too? Yeah, five other people did. We're onto this guy." You know? You never know.
He's a jerk. But Barton decides to keep it all to himself, and he tries to figure out what is going on. A week after getting this letter, Barton is again returning late home from Miss Montague's, taking the same street that he took the creepy footstep night.
Yeah, it's around 1 a.m. For some reason, I'm always surprised when these people from historical stories stay up as late as that. It's a dumb notion, but I go, I thought everybody in history went to bed early.
For some reason, I have that idea too. Maybe because there wasn't electric lights, and so you think that they would just go to bed because it was dark.
Right.
But no.
They stayed out partying in the gaslight.
They loved it. And again, he starts hearing the footsteps and he looks back. Nobody's there.
The way the steps change pace is pretty scary. It'll be slow. And then they'll suddenly break into a run. So it sounds like whoever it is coming at you. And then he'll turn and then nothing.
When he gets home, he can't sleep until the sun comes up. I get that, being scared out of your wits. But have you ever had a creepy nighttime walk experience, Pfeiffer? I mean, where you were scared, not where you were scaring other people.
Sure, I have. Have you?
I've been mugged at night, and that was pretty scary.
Oh, yeah.
A first date with this girl, and it was the end of the night, and I was walking her back to her place, and she lived over like on Fairfax and Melrose, that whole area there.
Yeah.
As we were walking and talking, having a good time, and I hear footsteps run up behind us. And this was the height of my Krav Maga training. I was taking Krav Maga for a few years.
Mm-hmm. I remember. I still have some bruises.
So I heard the footsteps and then my danger mode kicked in. And then I just remember calmly turning around and there was a dude who ran up and then he stopped and he pulled out a gun and he said, "Don't move." And I thought to myself, I can disarm this guy if he tries to get anywhere near me. And I know that that's a stupid thing to do, but in Krav Maga, we trained a lot with gun disarming. So I felt very confident about disarming people with guns. Maybe that would have been a mistake if I did that.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't do that.
I wasn't scared. It was all mathematics at that point. It's like, okay, if he does this, I will do that. But then a second dude came up from behind us, which was in front of us where we were before, and just says, "Give me your money."
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, crap, this is a no-win scenario because that guy's far away. He's got the gun, and this guy's got, there's nothing I can do. So I reached into my wallet and I just pulled out the money because I didn't want to give my whole wallet because then I'd have to get everything replaced.
Smart.
But he took it, and then it was only like maybe $5 in ones because it was the end of the night. Yeah. I spent all my cash.
Yeah.
And then she didn't fortunately have any jewelry or, like, you know, she had her keys in her bag, but they didn't even take her bag and they just ran off. But it totally ruined the date.
Oh, of course. Yeah. You can't come back from that.
Even in my advanced martial arts training where I felt confident I could disarm a guy with a gun, when there's a guy with a gun and a guy standing there, there's nothing he can do.
Well, no. Yeah. And even with the training, you know, why risk?
Of course. Over like $5.
Being paralyzed over five bucks. Or
it's ridiculous.
Whatever it is.
I don't walk anywhere anymore. If I go point A to point B, I have to either be in a little scooter or I drive.
Or your hang glider.
It works in Keithley because I live on a hill, so I can easily hang glide into town. But coming back, I have to take the bus.
Well, I remember that happening to you. That really sucks, man.
It did. Yeah, it's bad.
I had a similar experience that's maybe a little more like the story, but I didn't actually get mugged. It was I was in Chicago going to stay with a friend that lived there, but he wasn't home yet. I got there too early. It was nighttime, couldn't get up to his apartment. So I was walking around his neighborhood, which was unfamiliar to me, but seemed somewhat safe. I walked down the street and there was a park there. As I was walking by the park, there was a big guy on a bike who was riding, and he stopped suddenly and looked at me and gave me a really creepy look. It looked aggressive. I thought, what did I do? This is weird. I mean, it was definitely, you know, at me. And so I turned around and started walking a different way. And then I heard like crunch, crunch. Couldn't figure out what it was and looked over, and he was following me on the other side of the trees on his bike. And so I was like, I got to get out of this park. I think this guy's going to mug me or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. I didn't know what it was. And so I turned and I walked back into the neighborhood and then didn't see him. And I was like, okay, fine. I got away. And then I looked over and in the alleyway on the other side, he was in the alleyway following me on the bike. So I would just see him pass in between houses.
Yeah.
Oh man, I'm in trouble. So I did the same thing as this guy. Didn't want to run.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. In my head, I was going, if you run, it's sort of like when an animal's menacing you or
sure,
something.
Sure, yeah.
Because, you know, if you run, then it's on, you know? So I just kept walking, and then we came up to an intersection, and he pulled around where I could see him, and I thought, I can't let this go on, you know? And I stopped and turned around, and I said, can I help you with something? And this guy had the meanest face, and it suddenly brightened up into this big smile, and he goes, I don't know, can I help you with something?
And
I thought, oh, he's cruising me.
Yeah.
I just said, no, man. And I think the intent was clear. And he turned away and pedaled off into the night, you know. And then later when my friend came home, he said, oh, you shouldn't have gone down to that park because at night that's a cruising place. Yeah. Like, that's what everybody does down there. Well, I didn't know.
Yeah, of course not.
But I was really genuinely
scared.
Frightened.
Of course he would be, yeah.
You know, this guy was much bigger than me, and I have 1 week of karate training from when I was a kid, so I don't have your Krav Maga. Being followed is terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrible. Our protagonist, Captain Barton, he wakes up the next day, and he's got a new letter, same handwriting as before. And this one says, you may as well think, Captain Barton, to escape from your own shadow as from me. Do what you may. I will see you as often as I please, and you shall see me. For I do not want to hide myself, as you fancy. Do not let it trouble your rest, Captain Barton, for, with a good conscience, what need you fear from the eye of
the Watcher?
So we got a scary note, kind of a passive-aggressive, you know, it's like, I'm trying to help you out, but really I'm not. Kind of thing.
Well, I think the important thing about this note is that it suggests this isn't a random act.
Yes.
He says, with a good conscience, what need you fear?
Yeah.
Implying, I know you're afraid, and it's because you've done something wrong, right, and you know you deserve punishment for
it. Yeah. The letters are kind of proof of what has been going on for him, so he knows that he's not imagining the footsteps.
Right.
It's real, and other people can see these notes that he's got. You know, he's got, has servants. The servants know the real tangible things, and so he's like, this is really going on. I can't just dismiss this as fancy. So the captain, he gets really bummed out, but is quickly distracted by some business that comes up, preparation for the wedding, some kind of...
Well, he's got some kind of legal case that involves certain properties he's got to sort out. Yeah. He is living in a state of fear, but this business is a welcome distraction. It says the hurry and excitement of business had its natural effect in gradually dispelling the gloom.
So now we have personal account from the narrator, the Reverend.
Right. Around this time, the Reverend is out walking with a friend and Captain Barton.
Yeah. Captain Barton suddenly gets all jittery and later tells the Reverend that he hears footsteps. But chapter 3 gives us the actual perpetrator, and it isn't what I expected.
Yeah, hearing the footsteps isn't all of it. They meet somebody along the way.
As we were walking in at the passage from College Green, a man, of whom I remember only that he was short in stature, looked like a foreigner, and wore a kind of fur traveling cap, walked very rapidly and as if under fierce excitement directly towards us, muttering to himself fast and vehemently the while. This odd-looking person walked straight towards Barton, who was foremost of the three, and halted, regarding him for a moment or two with a look of maniacal menace and fury. And then, turning about as abruptly, he walked before us at the same agitated pace and disappeared at a side passage. I do distinctly remember being a good deal shocked at the countenance and bearing of this man, which indeed irresistibly impressed me with an undefined sense of danger, such as I have never felt before or since from the presence of anything human. But these sensations were, on my part, far from amounting to anything so disconcerting as to flurry or excite me. I had seen only a singularly evil countenance, agitated, as it seemed, with the excitement of madness.
A fur hat? Is this a mini Dr. Zhivago?
That wouldn't be scary at all. Omar Sharif, let's go.
But a small Omar Sharif. And that might be scary.
Oh, I don't know. That might be even better. Pocket-sized Omar? Give me five.
So he just walks up and he gives the captain a dirty look and then walks away.
Well, it says there's maniacal menace and fury in his look. I mean, he looks like he's going to come kick his ass or something, I think. It's not just a dirty look.
Potato, potato. It seems odd to the Rev, but it really freaks out Captain Barton, who is not a man easily freaked out.
He recoiled a step or two as the stranger advanced and clutched my arm in silence with what seemed to be a spasm of agony or terror. Really gets to him.
Barton asks what the short guy said. He said something, but the others couldn't quite hear him. And the Reverend and the other guy asks Barton if he's unwell, because he looks like he's a wreck now. And he says, no, I'm just tired. I got a lot going on. I'm going home. And he leaves.
And they want to walk him there, but he won't let them. He just goes off by himself. Possibly a little embarrassed, but mostly scared to death.
So the Reverend goes to check on him the next day, and the servant says that he's been in bed all day. He's not too ill. He just needs some rest. The Reverend sends for Dr. R to check on him, and the doc reports back to the Reverend. I guess there's no doctor-patient confidentiality in those days. But Barton is complaining of having headaches at times and some heart palpitations. He asks Barton if there is anything that he might be anxious about, but he, of course, denies it. The doc prescribes him something, but before he leaves, Barton asks him some questions.
Yeah, he's a little embarrassed to be asking these questions. He says they're going to be rather odd ones, perhaps, but as a wager depends upon their solutions, you will, I hope, excuse my unreasonableness. So Barton's making stuff up. First of all, he's saying he's got headache and palpitations. Yeah. She doesn't, probably.
No.
And now he's saying he's got a bet going, so that's going to explain why he asks these questions.
Very specific questions.
Right, he says, first, I want to know first about lockjaw. If a man actually has had that complaint and appears to have died of it, so much so that a physician of average skill pronounces him actually dead, may he, after all, recover?
The doc shakes his head.
If he did that MASH episode from the MASH report, seems like somebody can recover from death. So maybe he should have been addressing his questions to the writers of Trick or Treatment.
If it was Father Mulcahy that was there, then maybe yes, but he's not a part of the story.
Which I think the physician informs him of. Do not reference Father Mulcahy. And then the next question he asks, he says, suppose an ignorant pretender to medical skill, may he be so deceived by any stage of the complaint as to mistake what is only a part of the progress of the disease for death itself?
And the doc says, well, not anybody that's actually ever seen a dead person.
They're not going to mistake it for a case of lockjaw. And then the third question he asks, which is pretty funny, actually, he says, are the regulations of foreign hospitals such as that of, let us say, Naples? Like, right, he's pulling that out of the air. Sure.
Out of the air.
I don't know. Let's say Naples. Are those foreign hospitals very lax and bungling? May not all kinds of blunders and slips occur in their entries of names and so forth?
And the doctor is like, how am I supposed to know how crappy the doctors are in Naples? I don't know. I've never been to Naples. So he's got one final question.
Is there any disease in all the range of human maladies which would have the effect of perceptibly contracting the stature and the whole frame, causing the man to shrink in all his proportions and yet to preserve his exact resemblance to himself in every particular, with the one exception, his height and bulk? Any disease, Mark, no matter how rare, how little believed in generally, which could possibly result in producing such an effect?
He says, of course, no, that would not happen ever in a million years. Then Barton asks if there was any way to get an arrest warrant out on a lunatic. And the doc says, I'm a doctor, not a lawyer, but I guess you could. Whatever. And so the doc leaves, forgets something, goes back, and he notices that his prescription is burning in the fireplace.
Because he doesn't need it, because he was lying about all of his maladies.
Yeah.
So many mysteries at this point. I mean, what are these questions all about?
Yeah.
What? Why did he ask about lockjaw?
Yeah, at this point, we don't know.
But when I think of lockjaw, I just think of, you know, it's like a dental malady. But I guess what he really means is tetanus, which is interchangeable, because that can definitely kill you.
Yeah.
And also cause all sorts of physical issues in the rest of your body. And somebody who's not experienced might mistake that for that rigidity for death, right. I guess.
But with lockjaw, for me, I always think of the giant teleporting dog from the Inhumans.
You could think, sure.
Uatu and lockjaw in the same story.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. They both were on the moon.
No, it does make sense. I mean, this story is part of the Dolphinverse. It's part of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
It has tendrils that reach into almost every element of modern pop culture. I thought it was funny that, well, so one thing that's laid clear here at this point is when he says, is there anything that would shrink somebody down so they looked exactly the same, but they were like a dwarf version of themselves? That question kind of gives it away, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So clearly, I think at this point, it's like, okay, I did something bad. Somebody that I thought was dead wasn't really dead.
Right.
Now they're after me, but for some reason, they're shrunk down to like a mini-me version of themselves.
Which is very confusing and strange and weird in a weird fiction kind of way. A few days later, there's an advertisement in the Dublin newspapers. It says, Sylvester Yelland, formerly a foremastman on board His Majesty's frigate Dolphin, or his nearest kin, will apply to Mr. Hubert Smith, attorney at his office, Dame Street. He or they may hear of something greatly to his or their advantage. Admission may be had at any hour up to 12 o'clock at night. Again, they're staying up so late, these people.
I know.
Should parties desire to avoid observation and the strictest of secrecy as to all communications intended to be confidential shall be honorably observed.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a name, Sylvester Yelland, and Barton wants information about him. Again, the Dolphin was the ship that Barton captained, but this ad didn't really end up working out for him because nobody responded to it.
So we can assume that Sylvester Yelland might be the shrunken down man
that had lockjaw and died
and is now following him, calling himself the Watcher.
The Watcher came back as a miniature Dr. Zhivago. The Watcher is really just not that scary to me. I maybe because it's of Uatu, but the Watcher is just watching. He's not doing. The doing, that's the scary part.
Oh, I don't know. There's something creepy about being followed and watched. What do you mean? That's horrible. It's all the anticipation leading up to something happening. Even if something doesn't happen, being watched.
Yeah.
I don't know. I remember I had a friend who, his older sister was saying that she was seeing lights in her window at night. She thought that somebody was looking in at her.
Oh.
Parents were like, no, you know, you're imagining things. And then they were walking around by her, because her room was on the like basement level. So there was a window up at the top, like a garden apartment kind of situation. Yeah. And then once they found a footprint and a flashlight out there.
What?
And then it was never explained.
Weird.
Never found out who it was, why they were doing it. Just somebody looking in and watching her.
Oh.
And I wonder, why did they leave the flashlight there?
Yeah, you know, that's person. Why did they have two flashlights? Or
did they have to run away real quick? Or was it something to let the girl know that that was going
on? I guess if you're watching with the implication of later malice.
Yes.
That that's scary.
Absolutely.
But if somebody's just watching, you know, not that scared. Hey, I've been in plays. I've been on stage. I've had bunches of people watching me.
Well, you're inviting them to watch.
It's not scary.
But if that crowd were then to show up in your bathroom while you're taking a shower, you didn't invite them into that.
No. But if I'm walking down the street and there's a guy watching me,
mm-hmm.
big deal.
Yeah, I do a little dance.
Give him a little show. Say, hey, you like what you see? Get a drink of this, buddy. But anyway.
I think we've set up a lot of mystery here, and I think we can pay it off as much as you're able to with the conclusion of the story next week.
All right.
I want to thank Greg Johnson once again for doing an outstanding job reading.
Oh, my God. Greg Johnson, you are amazing, and Christmas Power is freaking amazing. And also, don't forget to catch Greg on the BBC 2, The MASH Report, not to be confused with the American MASH Report.
Right. The UK MASH Report, that'll be in January. That's on BBC 2. This American MASH Report, it comes out very infrequently, but I'm dying to get the next issue because I want to find out how that Marine got a billiard ball stuck in his mouth. That honestly is the greatest mystery of this whole episode. Thanks for listening. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.
Thank you.